There's this odd little story in the Christian scriptures recorded in the Gospels of both Mark and Matthew. Jesus goes over to a fig tree to get some figs to share with his friends, but there are no figs, only leaves. So Jesus, perhaps in a fit of pique, says to the tree, "May no one eat of your fruit ever again." Dun, dun, dun. The next day, they're all walking past that tree again, and one of Jesus' friends notices that now there are neither leaves nor fruit. Overnight, the tree has withered and died. That's how I feel. Now, I don't know exactly what the story is supposed to be teaching us, but I'm sure that there is many ways of interpreting it as there are people interpreting it. For my purposes this morning, I want to leave that little bit of magic aside and look at the story as one about a tree that had not lived up to its full potential and so withered and died. There are a lot of reasons plants fail to thrive. Most often it's because there's something that they need that they aren't getting. Too much or too little sun, too little or too much water, not enough nutrients in the soil. Plants don't just come to fruit and flower on their own. Without the resources they need, they may have all the good intentions in the world, all the heart, all the desire to be all that they can be, but they're not going to make it. At best, they'll become stunted versions of what they could have been. At worst, they'll wither and die. We see this in our own lives, don't we? If our relationships don't have the honesty, the commitment, the investment of time and heart that they need, they don't thrive, do they? If we're struggling with an addiction, yet are trying to do so on our own without the support of family, friends, sponsors, our recovery can be stunted. Take just about anything in your life, anything important, anything of value. If it doesn't get the resources it needs, it doesn't go very far, does it? Now, if the teaser on Facebook or Lori's opening words didn't telegraph it to you, I want us to look at the church, this church, our church, through the lens of the metaphor of a tree with neither leaves nor fruit, a tree that is withered and died because it hadn't had the resources it needed to live up to its full potential. Now, I don't think we're on the verge of withering and dying. I do think that we're not living up to our full potential. Now, if this is your first visit, or you've only been a few times, I'm hoping you won't find this to be too much insider talk, because I'm talking to you, actually, too. I deeply believe that we make of ourselves members of this community at the moment we decide to come back a second time. And if you keep coming back, the future of this community will rest as much in your hands as in those of the folks who've been part of this place for decades. This is not their church. It's ours. If we do this thing called community right, it's ours. All of ours. It belongs to us. And again, if we're doing this right, we belong to it. Yet from where I stand and sit and listen and work, play, pray, cry, and laugh with all of you, it is not entirely clear to me that we are doing this right. All congregations have their struggles, of course. All faith communities are, first and foremost, communities. Communities of trying our best yet fallible human beings. Still, there are stresses and strains in our system that worry me. The basic needs of plants are often summed up as water, sun, and nutrient-rich soil. Other things are involved, of course, and it's really the interplay among them that a plant needs to thrive. But the shorthand makes some sense: water, sun, nutrient-rich soil. For a congregation to thrive, there are a host of things that are needed as well, and it is really the interplay among them that is the most determinative. But I'd suggest that the needs of a congregation can also be summed up in three things, which conveniently all begin with the letter C: committed engagement, courage, and cash. I heard somebody say that. Now, each of these could be a sermon unto itself, several sermons, in fact, I'm sure. This morning, though, I'm going to focus on only one of them, the last of that set, cash. You probably know where this is going. But before I go there, I want you all to know that I know that as soon as I or anyone else begin to talk explicitly about money, it gets uncomfortable for some people. So I want to be as clear as I can be that I recognize the fact that we don't all live in the same economic reality. I strongly believe that one of our strengths as a community is that we are not the homogeneous, upper middle class, overly educated, Prius-driving stereotype that so many people have of Unitarian Universalists, and which even some of us have of ourselves. There are people like that here, of course. Yet our membership also includes people whose income is considerably less than upper middle class, and whose educational background doesn't include PhDs, and is far less formal. I deeply believe that this diversity is an asset if we can learn to really see and value it. As we said at the beginning of this service, and as we say each week, we all have a place here. We all are welcome here. Admittedly, we still have a ways to go before we're fully living into the truth of that, before we even fully understand what it means, I think. But I believe that that is where we're headed. All that said, I don't believe there is anyone here who can't pledge some amount of financial support. $1 a month. $1 a year. That might not seem like a lot of money, yet to my mind, all of these three C's are intertwined, and a pledge of $1 a month or $1 a year from someone who is living with little would be a more powerful demonstration of commitment than a much larger pledge from someone who's got a lot to spare. I would love to see more $10, $5, $1 pledges, because that would mean that we've reached a place where everyone can see that their contribution, no matter how seemingly small it might be, is really valued. And that they are really valued, no matter how seemingly little they have to give. On the other hand, to be both honest and blunt, there are a number of us who could afford to pledge far more than we currently do. Some, no doubt, think that we can't really need them to give that much more. After all, things seem to be going pretty well here. The truth is, blunt and honest, that we do not have and have not had for some time the kind of financial support that we need to survive, much less thrive, and live both into and out of our full potential. It may not look like it. I hope it doesn't look like it. But if we were a fig tree, I'd be hoping that Jesus didn't come by looking for a fig. The consultant who worked with us this summer said that he was surprised at how remarkably low the the percentage of congregational giving in this congregation is. And that's from someone who works with Unitarian Universalists who have a national reputation for being among the least financially supportive of our congregations. And even in that context, he said he was surprised at how poorly we support ourselves. But not for lack of trying. The consultant also said that it was clear to him that the people who have been running our pledge drives over the years have known what they were doing and have run really good campaigns. We've been doing the right things, yet for some reason our level of pledging has remained essentially static for quite some time, declining slightly even in the last couple of years. I'll name it. There is no question that for the first 4 or 5 years, our mutual ministry was rocky. There was a fairly widespread dissatisfaction with my performance as lead minister, and I would have to say, rightly so. Of course, there are lots of explanations, but no excuse. The results of the 2015 congregational survey, which the Committee on the Ministry will be repeating this year, those results were a real wake-up call and a catalyst for change, several changes, in the ways I do what I do. In the ensuing years, it seems that most folks say that they felt real and meaningful improvement. Yet while the dissatisfaction could no doubt explain some of the financial reticence of some members, the basic trend we're wrestling with was here before I came and has continued despite those improvements. Now, some say that we're too big of a congregation, that our ambitions outstrip our willingness to support them. We may want to be a larger, so-called program size congregation. We may try to act like one, yet these folks say we demonstrate year after year that we're really only interested in being a smaller pastoral size church because we show ourselves year after year that that's all we're able or willing to afford. The answer to our financial stuckness, then, is to stop trying to be what we're not. Find a more natural equilibrium. Shift our ambitions to meet our realities and to live within our means. And we could certainly do this. There can be great wisdom in vigorously pruning a plant that has grown too large. Sometimes the cutting back is so severe that it can look to the untrained eye that you've killed the thing. Yet in the spring, the plant could come back stronger than ever. So we could cut back here. To do so, you would have to cut back on staff. There is simply nothing else to cut in our budget that would have any substantive impact. So you could ask me or Leah to take a 50% pay cut. You could decide to eliminate one or more of the part-time positions we have here, like the office manager, the assistant minister, or the director of music, asking volunteers to take on these roles. But make no mistake, cutting staff in one way or another is the only way to live within our means through cutting expenses. Oh, we'd also have to decide which 100 or so members we'd want to ask to leave. Because it's a fact that we are already severely understaffed for our size. If we decided to cut back on staff so as to live within our means, you will also have to reduce the number of people who can call this their spiritual home. There is another option, the only other option as I see it, and to my mind, the only viable option. Rather than cutting back, we could invest more. But how can we do that in the light of what I've been saying about how we don't even have enough as it is? With faith. With courage. Farmers and others know that sometimes when you don't have enough, you need to invest what you don't have in order to reap the increased harvest that you believe is possible. Sometimes you sell off some of what you have so that you can invest it in what you need. And we did that when we sold U House to pay for the renovations on Summit and the creation of our beautiful lower hall. But sometimes you need to take out a loan to pay for new seed or new equipment or something that you don't have yet, can't currently afford on your own, yet know in your bones will make all the difference in the world to your future success. It's scary for sure, and is rarely, if ever, a sure thing. It is always possible to dig yourself even deeper into a hole than you were before. That's true. So it is a risk, a gamble. Yet sometimes it is the only thing to do, and you'll do it if you're truly committed to your vision and you have the courage of your conviction. Last year, the board was courageous in asking the congregation to do just that, to take a little risk, to borrow now so that we can reap a greater harvest tomorrow. To, paraphrasing Dr. King, take the first step even though we don't see the whole staircase. There was some vocal and very heartfelt opposition from some longtime members who also, it must be said, have their understanding of the best interest of the church in mind. Even so, the majority of the congregation agreed that the promise of the future is worth a short-term risk and is worth investing in. My friends, we are capable of being so much more. We are so much more than what our long echoing narratives of scarcity and fear have told us we can be. A few years back, during a board retreat, someone used these words to describe their vision for our congregation: a powerhouse for racial justice. I'm hoping that we'll have that on t-shirts as part of our 75th anniversary celebration, a powerhouse for racial justice. Recently, Sally Taylor, our unofficial church historian, shared with me a sermon that longtime member Virginia James had given to her. It was preached here in 1983, the 40th anniversary of the congregation's founding, and was delivered by the first settled minister to serve this community, the Reverend Malcolm Sutherland. In describing those earliest years of this congregation, Reverend Sutherland said, "We stood unequivocally for human justice, and here that meant racial justice. From our earliest days, we have understood this to be our mission." He said further that in those early days, when there was talk of trying to become a truly integrated congregation, some of the African American leaders encouraged us in those efforts, yet also said, "We would much rather see you a strong white church fighting for equal rights than a small interracial church too weak to have any effect." I see in that a charge to become the powerhouse for racial justice that we are today reclaiming as our vision. And it's not just an idle vision, this desire to live into our full potential to which we were called in the days of our founding. The future the board last year asked you to invest in, and that I this morning am asking you to invest in, we've seen it. We saw it. We tasted it this summer, following the awful events of August 12th, which put the name of our city on national lips. Many of you know the story. One day, our director of administration and finance, Christina Rivera, fielded a call asking if the Reverend Jesse Jackson could preach here that coming Sunday. Of course, Reverend Jackson could have spoken at any of the prominent African-American congregations in this city, but he wanted to speak in a predominantly white congregation so as to recognize the truth that all of us, however we identify, are in this struggle together. Reverend Jackson said that our congregation, this congregation, had been recommended to him as a predominantly white congregation that not only talked about racial justice, but was active in trying to achieve it. This congregation, which worked in its infancy for indiscriminate seating on buses, the hiring of African Americans onto the city's police force, the movement of African American patients from hospital hallways to rooms, and the use of respectful titles in newspapers. This congregation, the only public place where a small, informal, and impromptu interracial square dance could break out in celebration of the Supreme Court's declaration that separate but equal is not constitutional, because ours was the only public building in Charlottesville in which integrated gatherings were permitted, which led to a cross being burned on our property. This congregation, which opened the first integrated preschool in the city. This congregation, which the local chapter of Black Lives Matter has said it knows it can count on. This congregation, in which there are individuals whose work in preparing for August 12th can, without hyperbole, be said to have saved lives that day. This is the congregation where Reverend Jesse Jackson chose to speak. Those who were here experienced the buzz, like the crackle of electricity, as our members stepped forward, hell, leapt forward, to engage, to be useful, to be part of it all. And we saw this sanctuary filled to overflowing. In fact, the social hall, which we had designated to be a place for that overflow, itself overflowed so that people had to go out into the lawn where we had set up some chairs. And those who were here could feel it. That Unitarian Universalist congregation, this congregation, was living both into and out from its full potential. It was an extraordinary day. And Reverend Jackson underscored this vision of who we are when he came to us again and asked us to host the leadership summit that he was calling for when he returned to Charlottesville a month or so later to launch a bus tour for voter rights across Virginia. This is who we can be. This is who we are, if only nascently. Yet, we can be the powerhouse for racial justice, so very many of us believe we can and should be, only if, we believe in this vision and act on that belief. We can only ensure that our tree has not just leaves, but flower and fruit as well, and for years and years to come, if each of us and all of us will have the courage to step up the level of our committed engagement and, to be blunt and honest again, to increase the amount of cash we're willing to give.